Okay,
we have to get the consent on tape.
Just say, offer your consent again.
I consent, as long as you guys don't mind the occasional holler of a baby in the background. So,
congratulations.
Thanks.
The formalities. This is November 12th, 2010. We're with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, and we're here this afternoon with Bethany McLean, author of the recently released All the Devils Are Here, The Hidden History of the Financial Crisis, as well as a reporter over the last few years on a lot of issues that relate to financial crisis. The Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission was created last year by statute. It's a bipartisan commission, and our task, or the task of our commission, is to investigate the causes of the financial crisis and the collapse or near collapse of major U.S. institutions, and to deliver such report to Congress December 15th, which we are making every effort to do in our last few weeks. over the course of the last...
That doesn't sound like fun.
No.
couple of weeks.
Over the course of the last 12 months, we have... made many rounds investigating many things, and that brings us to you as someone who has reported on and written about many of the things we've looked at over the past 12 months. With that, I'll turn it back over to Susan.
Kirsten. Let's go around. I thought, let me tell you who we are. There's four of us at the table, and Kim is calling in also from a location elsewhere. I'm Kirsten Downey. I'm a writer and investigator for the report.
I'm Mike Easterly. I'm also with the FCIC.
Donna Norman with the FCIC as well.
And Alexis Simmendinger, and I'm part of the writing team at the FCIC.
Kim, did you want to add anything specifically about yourself?
I'm in New York, and my last name is Schaefer. And I have a background in structured products.
Actually,
I probably should be more specific. I was the senior managing director at Bear Stearns.
Okay.
And whenever anyone talks about Bear Stearns at the commission, I usually run away, so there's no conflict.
Well, our book contains very little about Bear Stearns, so, and I think absolutely nothing fresh whatsoever, so we shouldn't have a problem.
Great. When you think back of the research that you did for the book, what are the main points that you came away with? What are the main things that you think are important, and what do you think are the most important things for us to tell the American people?
Oh, good heavens. I guess I don't come from any ideological bias whatsoever, but if I started the book with any kind of bias, it was a bias that people should be responsible for themselves. And I even wrote an op-ed for the New York Times in the early stages of reporting the book about when this anger toward the banks was first starting to manifest itself, reminding everybody, well, what about the borrowers? We're to blame for this too. And I suppose one of my big surprises in writing the book was, I wouldn't say the research changed my mind about that, because I think self-responsibility is a huge thing, but I was very surprised by the extent to which loans were sold rather than bought. And I thought, and we cite in the book some of the Washington Mutual evidence that you turned up about the incentives that Washington Mutual had, for instance, to sell option arms instead of 30 rate fixed year loans, and the push for that. I think another aspect of that was surprising to me is that you always hear, whenever there's a threat of any kind of change, and you still hear it today, increased regulation, whatever it is, that, well, this will cause credit to dry up. And I guess I would have thought that community organizations throughout the 90s and the early part of this decade would have been demanding increased credit, get us more loans, make more credit available. And it was quite to my surprise to discover that the opposite was true, and that the community activists were some of the voices out there from the 1990s on saying, you have to stop this. People are getting loans they can't pay back. And so I started to fundamentally question where that push for credit comes from, whether it comes from consumers wanting credit first or whether it comes from the lending industry knowing that it can make fees on by offering credit and thinking that they were exempt from the need for consumers to pay it back thanks to rising home prices.
So over
there. And I guess a third thing I would offer is just the complexity of the relationship between the GSEs and the private market. And I think people, depending on their ideological biases, want to find an easy answer in that, well, it has to be all the fault of the banks or it has to be all the fault of the GSEs. And I think the truth is much more complex and nuanced.
Yeah, it was an interesting way that you ended the chapter about the GSEs, saying that you didn't know if they were the victims or the victimizers.
Right, a little bit of both.
Yes. And I think, you know, one of the things that we've really seen with this is people have had each a desire. You know, it seems like a lot of the people who've looked at the situation have wanted there to be one bad actor or one set of bad actors.
Yeah.
And I guess...
Yeah.
What is,
we called the book All the Devils Are Here, not so much because we're specifically calling anybody a devil, although there obviously are characters who figure prominently in the book, but more because we were trying to get at the complexity of this and the fact that it was so many decisions made by so many different people over the span of decades that came together, and you can't point your finger at just one actor and say, ah, I found it, there's our villain.
Right.
What's your list of villains look like? Can you summarize it?
You guys have the book, so it's probably better for you to look at it than for me to. I don't have one sitting in front of me right now. But we really focused the book, and mainly because you couldn't tell every single part of it, we focused the book on Fannie Mae, on some of the decisions made by Congress from Bob Rubin to, and regulators from Bob Rubin to Alan Greenspan. And the book also, countrywide, and sort of the history of subprime lending, stretching back into the hard money lenders. So the book focuses intensely on the Ameriquest and Roland Arnall's empire. And then stretching through to Wall Street, primarily Merrill Lynch and Goldman Sachs, and sort of how that connected with AIG. And so that's the arc of the book.
So that sounds like Bob Rubin, Alan Greenspan, Angelo Mozzillo, Roland Arnall.
Goldman Sachs. And
is there anyone in particular at Goldman
book
Sachs?
The book is more nuanced than calling all of these people mm-hmm. devils, so I just want to caveat it that way. But Goldman Sachs, from Hank Paulson to Lloyd Blankfein, Merrill Lynch focusing on Stan O'Neill, AIG focusing on Hank Greenberg and Joe Cassano. I'm trying to think about some of the other chapters. And Fannie Mae really focusing on the reigns of David Maxwell, Jim Johnson, and Frank Rains. And then finally, the Dan Mudd years.
Now, did you focus on Goldman Sachs and Merrill Lynch on account of you had better sources, or was there a particular other reason that you decided to focus on them?
I think the main reason we did is that they were a point-counterpoint in some ways, because Merrill Lynch was one of the firms on Wall Street that suffered most acutely from Goldman envy and wasn't content to be what it was and wanted to replicate the phenomenal returns that Goldman made, that Goldman produced by trading. And I think that drove a lot of the desire for those type of profits, drove a lot of Merrill's decision. So I think we liked the narrative setup of that. It's not that you couldn't have told the Wall Street story through Citigroup, through Bear Stearns, maybe through Lehman, although I think in the end Lehman's problems were more related to commercial real estate than they were to its residential mortgage lending. So that felt slightly off. And then Goldman, because I think the metamorphosis of Goldman tells a lot about the change on Wall Street. It was the last Wall Street firm to go public, and I think that caused a profound change in Goldman's culture, and it's, you know, maintained this our number one priority as our clients. Our clients' interests only come first, and I always come first. And I think the detail that has come out in the wake of the financial crisis about Goldman's dealings in the mortgage market proved that that's not true. And I think we liked that angle because there was always that whisper about Goldman on Wall Street for the last, you know, I don't know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years. It's been a long time, but nobody could ever prove it or substantiate the whispers in any way. And the public spotlight that's been shown on Goldman's dealings in the mortgage market is the first time that you look at it and you say, oh, that's how they operate. So I think that the transformation of one firm and then the point counterpoint with Goldman and Merrill is a lot of the reason that we chose those two. And Goldman also, while they weren't a huge player in underwriting RMBS and in underwriting CDOs, cash CDOs, they were a huge player in synthetic CDOs and played a big role in their invention. And so that also tied into the narrative.
You didn't mention Dick Fuld. Would you put him on?
You know, we didn't focus on Lehman intensely. We've got a little bit in the last chapter of the book, but I don't think any of the insights about Lehman are particularly fresh. And I suppose that's the reason we didn't do that is partly a reason the story has been so well told and so well reported in so much detail that it was hard to see what we were going to add. I think partly, as I said earlier, while Lehman did a lot of sleazy things in the residential mortgage arena, I think in the end the reason the firm fell and the problem assets on its book were really commercial real estate rather than residential real estate. So in the end the point was less clean than it is with Merrill Lynch. And what else? I think I had a third point, but those are the two main reasons. Really, nothing. We didn't have anything fresh to add, and it didn't tie into the point of our narrative as much as Merrill Lynch did. And oh yeah, and then the third reason is just lack of space. You know, you could devote a separate chapter to every single person, every single entity that ever encountered the subprime crisis, but then we might have your report instead of our book. So.
Yeah, and then you'd be dealing with congressional mandate. Yeah,
right.
What do you think were your most important discoveries?
Let's see. I'm reluctant to phrase these as discoveries because I guess it's more. I'm not sure all of this is incredibly fresh or unique to us, but I'll phrase it instead the most important points of the book maybe. But I think where subprime lending really came from and the growth of subprime lending, starting with this first wave of subprime lending in the 1990s. I think there's still this public perception that subprime lending was started by the GSEs or started by Countrywide and kind of came into being this decade, and it really didn't. And most of the players that populated this industry came out of hard money lending, and they grew up in the 1990s, and the companies and people that went on to dominate this industry came out of that. And I think both Countrywide and the GSEs were playing catch up. They were followers to an extent, not leaders. And the story for both the Countrywide and the GSEs is different. But I think that's part of it. I think part of it, another important, and I think this is a pretty unique insight, is that I really question, and I don't have the access to data to prove this point, apart from a few data points, but. You know, this crisis has really been painted as one about home ownership, that it proves that you shouldn't put people into homes when they can't afford, and that this was augmented and caused by America's belief in home ownership. And I think home ownership provided a cover for a lot of unseemly practices that had nothing to do with home ownership. But in the end, most subprime lenders specialized in the great volume of their business, two-thirds or more, were cash-out refinancings. It was never about home ownership. And if the government had, I firmly believe that if the government had, and I'm not saying this is wise policy, but if the government had had a a law that subprime loans could only be used for the first-time purchase of a house, I don't think we would have had a subprime crisis, because so many of them were used for either investor loans for buying second or third properties or for cash-out refinancings. And so I think the crisis thought of properly is a credit crisis, but it's not. And I'm not saying homeownership is or isn't a good policy. I actually would probably be biased towards saying it isn't, and people should rent. But in the end, I don't think this crisis proves it one way or the other, because that's the data just does not support the fact that that's what this is about. AmeriQuest business was 100% cash out refinancings. New Century's business, 2/3 refinancing. Countrywide business, 2/3 refinancing. That's not putting people into houses. So I think, let's see, what else? What else? I think another really important aspect of all of this is risk management on Wall Street, and the way in which the development of quantitative measures of risk fooled Wall Streeters into thinking that they had this stuff under control when they really didn't. And, you know, I don't know, I think risk management is sort of like UFOs. You know, a lot of people on Wall Street claim to have seen it, but can anybody prove it actually exists? And it's kind of stunning if you go back and look at firms' 10-Ks and their presentations to analysts and how much they talk about their ability to manage risk and how absolutely non-existent that capacity turned out to be. And so in the book, we trace the development of some of these tools, particularly value at risk, and how that led Wall Street to think it had a better handle on things than it did. I guess another thing, and I still haven't kind of philosophically or theoretically pounded this out, but, you know, this whole notion that competition is supposed to result in the best coming out on top, and in so many cases in the makings of this crisis, what you saw is that competition instead created a race to the bottom, whether it was with the rating agencies, whether it was with the investment banks and risk-taking, whether it was with Countrywide and subprime lending, that in an effort to keep up with where the market was going, participants repeatedly lowered their standards. And so instead of the best ones winning, it was the one who was willing to do the worst things appeared to be winning. And I'm not really sure what that says or what that means, but I think it leaves a question mark hovering over this notion that the best automatically emerges from competition, given that so much of it turned into this race to the bottom. And I think, I guess I'd come back to, again, the complexity of the GSEs and Wall Street. I guess I came to think of the relationship with the GSEs and the private sector as kind of like mutually assured destruction, in the sense that subprime lending came out of the private sector and was initially fed by Wall Street, and the GSEs, by their massive buying power, definitely inflated the bubble. I don't see how you can argue that wasn't the case. Definitely inflated the bubble bigger than it would have been, thereby assuring both Wall Street's destruction and their own. And I think it's a complex process by which that happened, but it isn't all the fault of one party or the other.
What did you observe about...
Does that answer the question?
Yes. What did you come away with on supervision and regulation?
I guess I came away with a somewhat skeptical view of regulation, in the sense that a lot of this is the willingness of regulators to enforce existing laws and the ability of regulators to cast a skeptical eye on what regulatees and the market is doing, and both were profoundly lacking during the crisis. I think the Fed had the powers it needed under HOPA. Had they chosen to use them to squash some of the worst practices in subprime lending, and they chose not to do so. There's some pretty shocking stuff that came out of some GAO studies about what the federal regulators knew about banks' risk management programs, and you know, you just wonder when you look at this whether any regulator has the capacity to stay one step ahead of Wall Street and kind of where the will to regulate actually is.
Do you think they're capable of it, or you're questioning the will to do it?
Well, it's kind of the same thing, right? I mean, they're both part and parcel of the same thing. In order to be capable of it, you have to have the will to stand up to the industry, and you have to have the capacity to be skeptical and to see what everybody is doing and say, just because everybody is doing it doesn't make this a good idea. And there aren't a lot of people in our world who have the genuine capacity to be skeptical. I'm not sure I do. You know, I can recognize skepticism when I hear it and recognize a good argument and be sort of independent-minded enough to say, that makes sense. But I don't know that I have that insight into things. But there are, you know, certainly people who do, from people who are critics of the housing market to, you know, people who are critics of some of what they saw going on in securitization, to the people who shorted subprime securities, who looked at this and said, wow, this really makes no sense whatsoever. And you wonder why, if all those people could see it, why couldn't anybody on the regulatory side see it? And there, that I do chalk up to an inability to look at the world in a skeptical way, because I don't think, you know, if the Federal Reserve had, or anybody else, had, or the OCC or the OTS had seen a massive financial crisis coming, I don't think they would have just sat there. They just didn't. They didn't put it together the way skeptical minds did.
You mentioned something a little while ago that I wanted to follow up on, and that was how you had seen consumer activists had had really tried to not encourage this kind of lending, but actually were trying to discourage it, contrary to a lot of the perceptions. And there were many, many times that community activists sent letters. We've come across a voluminous record of letters, public hearings, contacts, petitions, all the ways that the consumer activists tried to get regulators' attention to the problem. Why do you think they were so ignored?
I think that's a great question, and we focus on that in the book. And I guess I would cite a few reasons. I'd cite the power of the lending industry and the argument that if you do this, then you will cut people's access to credit. And the notion that's still prevalent today, that cutting people's access to credit is a bad thing. And I guess I hear that and I ask, whatever happened to living within your means? Why is cutting people's access to credit necessarily a bad thing? So I guess that would be the first thing. I think secondly is this mantra of home ownership, that even though this, as I said earlier, I don't think was really about home ownership, it was all wrapped in the rubric of home ownership, or the fabric of home ownership, and because of that, it gave the lenders a moral superiority that they otherwise would have lacked, because they could say we're putting people in homes. And it was difficult for politicians to stand in the way of that. Lobbying dollars, which I'm sure you guys can track. I don't know. I would guess that lenders contribute significantly more money to Congress than community groups do. I think you can't discount Alan Greenspan's intellectual force in all of this. I think the fact that people told us that the fact that the chairman of the Federal Reserve, who at that time was basically a deity, didn't want to do anything about this and didn't think anything should be done, had a squelching effect on everybody else. And so I think the power of one man's intellectual intimidation can't be underestimated, and so I think that was part of it too. And then I think, to some credit to the regulators, it's really hard to figure out what the right thing to do is. I mean, if you guys haven't, and I'm sure you probably have, but I went through all of the public transcripts of the hearings that the Federal Reserve held in the summer of 2000, when community activists were really arguing we need to stop this now, and the Fed conducted these public hearings around the country. And you realize, when you listen to the lenders talk about certain loans and why somebody would need a no documentation loan, that it's it's not easy. There is some truth to the notion that it's not easy to determine what a predatory loan is, and that a loan that's really bad for one person can be really good for somebody else. And so this stuff is squishier than it may appear. It's not like you can say a blanket moratorium across certain types of lending and bingo, we fixed the problem. And if you do that, you're going to get complaints from people who you've caused a problem for by doing that. So it's not an easy thing to fix. That said, I think that the fact that something isn't easy to do doesn't excuse you from not doing it, especially when it was just so crystal clear that people were getting loans they couldn't pay back. And any system in which lots of people are getting loans they can't pay back, well, something's broken, right?
Right. When you went through and read the hearings, you saw exchanges that occurred with what consumer activists said and then what officials said in response. From those conversations, could you have predicted that the regulators would in fact do nothing?
I don't think I can answer that, because I see that with the benefit of hindsight that they did do nothing. So I see it through that lens already. When I read through those hearings, I approach them with the knowledge that the regulators were going to do nothing. So I don't think I can look at that the way I would if I were reading it and trying to make an independent judgment.
Yeah, I guess I'm just asking this because I found this very fascinating in reading a lot of the hearing testimony myself.
Yeah.
And I'm just trying to understand how it is that people can be bringing very good information, very good solid information, and constantly
and
be told it's anecdotal or your data isn't good enough or the
I don't know. I don't know. I think it's a really great question, and I've given my sort of non-quantitative factors in response, and I firmly believe all of those things were factors, but I offer them as explanations, not as excuses. And I don't, you know, it gets to a fundamental point as well, that there's this division, or has been historically in regulation, between consumer protection and banking safety and soundness. And what you would think any safety and soundness regulator would have realized in these hearings is, once again, people are getting loans they can't pay back. And that's not, given that sound loans are at the heart of a sound banking system, you'd think any safety and soundness regulator would say, oh. And I guess that does lead to a very important point that I neglected, which is that people don't seem to have thought through the ultimate consequences. I mean, it wasn't, oh, people are getting loans they can't pay back, and if home prices start rising, the losses are going to land somewhere. It was, oh, and this is a really important point, I should have said it earlier, sorry, it's that people, regulators all thought the losses were being, the risk was being moved out of the regulated financial system, so they thought, not my problem.
Uh-huh.
And former regulators told us that explicitly, there's some of that in the book. There was definitely an attitude of the risk is out of the regulated banking system, so it's not our issue.
So I'll be gone. You'll be gone. Isn't just on Wall Street. It's in Washington too.
Right. Well, not even really that, but rather more just not our problem. You know, wherever the losses are, they're not in our regulated institutions. And you look back on that and say, oh my God, how could they not realize that the very process of securitization, that the loans were moving through the regulated banking system, and by virtue of that, as your structured finance expert knows better than I do, pieces of the risk are getting left in the regulated banking institution, warehoused there for long periods of time and even staying there permanently. And the notion that the risk was just moving through the system was just totally flawed. But people don't seem to have put that together.
I'm just curious, did you find in your conversations about that the folks you talked to were rueful, somewhat unhappy to realize in hindsight that that was the case? Because in some of the conversations that I recall that we've had here, that ruefulness was not there. In other words, they felt like they played by the rules that they were given. They stayed in their lane.
Yeah.
I think it's much more
the latter.
Mm-hmm.
Some people, the former a little bit, some people who within the system tried to do something about it and felt squashed. I think there's a ruefulness, but also some anger that they tried to speak up and only to be sort of squashed by their superiors.
Mm-hmm.
So I did, but from more senior level people, no. I mean, the attitude is just, it's just not our fault.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any way of expressing to us an opinion about whether after the crisis the incentive system has changed to make, I'm talking outside of Dodd-Frank, but that the incentive system yep. internally may have changed enough to alter that behavior?
I don't think so, and here's why, and I haven't because I was so, I should offer an apology and a caveat, first of all, because I was so, because I was working 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, finishing the book over the summer, I'm still less familiar with exactly what's been implemented in incentive programs and various
sure.
banks to be really sure about this. But, you know, the whole notion of skin in the game is configured too simplistically in that everyone says, well, there was no skin in the game, and that's the problem, and now if we have skin in the game, we'll fix it. And it's not true, because there was skin in the game all along. Countrywide and Washington Mutual both basically ended up almost going under because they had skin in the game, because they kept this stuff on their balance sheet. And Wall Street firms like Merrill Lynch and Citigroup almost went under because they kept this stuff on their balance sheet. They had skin in the game. And so the problem is long-term skin in the game versus short-term skin in the game. And it's what you said earlier, you'll get yours and I'll be gone, you'll be gone, and you'll get yours and I'll get mine, and we'll be out. And so even if a company is keeping skin in the game, if the individuals are able to get well paid in the short term for and get out in, or collect millions of dollars or big sums of money, it long term, the skin in the game doesn't really matter. You know, if you agree to pay me $5 million this year and I have a $10 million promise five years down the road, and I don't know how much do I care about the $10 million 5 years down the road, I'll take my $5 million today. Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah.
I'm not sure I'm expressing it that well, but that's so I worry about that with respect to the incentive system, that it's not just skin in the game, it's also an issue of corporate skin in the game versus individual skin in the game, and it's an issue of timing. And if anybody's short-term rewards are high enough versus the long-term rewards, then the long-term rewards are going to become somewhat less important versus what you can get today in the here and now. So I worry about that in terms of the incentive system having changed. And I don't know if you guys have been struck by this, and this is so purely anecdotal. I've never written it because it's too anecdotal, but I have detected in working a little bit on this foreclosure scandal a definite attitude from the banking community that who cares about the procedures? I mean, God, these people clearly can't pay their loans, and they got themselves into this mess in the first place, and they deserve to lose their homes, and all these attorneys and consumers who are complaining that the process wasn't followed, well, oh, just more of the same. And it just strikes me that this gap between, and I'm generalizing, but this gap between how the financial industry thinks and how consumers think has just gotten wider and wider here since the financial crisis.
Well, the gap between what the lending industry thinks and what the law is, too.
Yeah, that might be another way of putting it.
You know, we do have a couple hundred years of common law around real estate transactions.
Exactly. Right. I know. I wrote a little op-ed for The Guardian pointing out that, and this is off the subject, but pointing out that, you know, criminals get their murder convictions overturned because of tiny violations in due process, right? So, come
right.
on.
Right.
But anyway. So yeah, so I do worry a lot about that issue, because in the end I do think a lot of this comes down to individual incentives. So it's not, you can't just think in terms of corporate incentives, you have to think in terms of individual incentives.
Mm-hmm. In terms of individual incentives, one of the things that I found unusual or surprising was that AIGFP, the people on the staff had to keep half of their pay, you know, as subordinated capital in the firm for 4 years. I
yeah.
imagine you're aware of that.
Uh-huh.
And yet, nevertheless, they still, you know, took these risks. And I'm wondering if you got any sense of how, or a feel of how these things come together, or what sort of explanation there might be.
Well, I'd offer 2 points, I guess, and the first is my former point, which is if you're getting paid, I don't know, $5 million a year and $2.5 million is up front and $2.5 million has to stay for tied up in the firm or whatever the dollars are to you, everybody has different standards, but you know, you may care less about the $2.5 million that has to stay in the firm if you're getting lots and lots of money up front too. So I don't know that necessarily fixes things. But I guess the second and probably more important point is that you just can't underestimate the amount of incompetence in the world. And that's why we focused on the failures of Wall Street risk management, because I mean, of course, if any of these people at AIG, if any of the people at Merrill Lynch, if any of the people at Citigroup had seen what they were actually doing, nobody wanted to destroy the financial system, and nobody wanted to bring their companies down. And they didn't see it. You know, and despite all their talk about sophisticated risk management and models and all these quantitative measures of measuring risk, they simply didn't see it. They didn't get it. And I think that's a profoundly kind of scary statement about the modern world of finance, right? And why one of the reasons we liked both the Merrill Lynch and AIG stories so much is that these firms were taking risks that ultimately brought their companies to the brink of going under, and they didn't know. It's not like they were doing it and taking a big gamble and saying, okay, if we do this, we'll get rich. They didn't know.
Did you run across any?
And often they were taking, when you look at the what AIG was getting paid on those AAA, to insure those AAA tranches, and the return Merrill Lynch was earning by keeping those AAA tranches on its balance sheet, it was pitiful. I mean, Goldman Sachs didn't keep the AAA tranches because they didn't think the return was worth it. I know. So it's not like any of these guys were swinging for the fences in order to get rich. You know, or at least, well, they were, but they didn't understand that they were.
Did you run across any evidence that they thought if they did get in trouble that the U.S. government would be there to bail them out?
I didn't run across any explicit evidence of that, no.
Okay.
No. But I saw, there was a paper by the New York Federal Reserve, and I wish I could point you guys to it precisely. I want to say it was 2005, but it was something, and it was talking about the way that the debt of the big banks traded, and the credit spreads on the big banks' debt implied that there was a federal guarantee, that it wasn't trading as if, and it wasn't trading as if these were truly standalone firms. And you know, it's kind of an interesting irony. The GSEs, Fannie and Freddie, always made the argument that if they had an implicit government guarantee, well, so did the big banks. And, you know, in the end, it turned out they were right.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Kim?
Yes. Hi. Yes.
Did you have a question?
No, I've been fascinated. I'm looking forward to reading the book. I probably have a comment or two.
Good, comment.
Well, this is, I worked for the Senate Banking Committee during the thrift crisis and was staff director of the Consumer and Regulatory Affairs Subcommittee, dealt with CRA and other consumer issues, but dealt regularly with the consumer representatives. And my takeaway from that experience is all you said about the money and the contributions and all of that is quite true. But it's also that these were consumer activists who didn't have organized consumer groups at home who were then contacting their senators, so that Washington perceived that these were smart do-gooders who had a particular point of view, but it didn't necessarily represent voters.
Interesting.
That was a perception that was probably colored by the importance of money in reaching voters. And so it's true that AARP actually had somewhat more credibility 20 years ago with the Senate Banking Committee as a consumer representative than some other consumer groups, because they were perceived as not connected to voters or representing poor people who didn't vote, or one could become fairly cynical.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
Nonetheless, Senator Dixon of Illinois did some good things about CRA when I worked for him.
Let me just ask something else and see what both you say. I'd just be curious. Because I'm trying to understand how people can be presenting very specific information repeatedly and not be heard at all. Do you think a lot of it had to do, could some of it also have to do that a lot of the people who are raising these issues were women?
Wow. I honestly don't know. Anything I said on that would just be a matter of opinion, so I'm not going to say anything.
Well, thank goodness you don't have any of those.
I have lots of those on areas when I have some research to back up my opinions, but when I just have opinion, I try to usually stay quiet.
Sounds good. Does anybody else have any other questions?
I have some questions, but they're the kind that ask at the end.
That's okay.
Okay. Yeah. I was curious. You reported on Enron.
Yeah.
While it's somewhat of a stretch, there are similar issues or some continuities with Enron in terms of having special purpose vehicles off of the balance sheet, structured finance. You have some of the same players in terms of Citi and that sort of thing. Did you continue to cover those issues? And I'm wondering sort of what came out of that, what the resolution was or why it wasn't resolved.
That's a great question. I actually did an op-ed for The Guardian at one point talking about the similarities between Enron and the credit crisis, and it was early on. So I saw them too. I didn't really continue to work on these issues because, to be perfectly frank, I guess I was still naive in the wake of Enron, and I thought two things. I thought that all this was going to get fixed because, of course, it was all going to get fixed because it was obvious what a problem it was. And I guess I also thought that, well, I've seen a great financial conflagration in my lifetime as a journalist, and that's going to be it. You know, there's one scandal per generation.
Right.
So I guess I was both naive and didn't understand my new favorite cliche, which is that expect the unexpected. But I was absolutely stunned to discover that with SIV that you could have a company could have a credit line out to an SIV for less than 365 days and didn't have to take a capital charge on it. I mean, that was just astounding to me. And that Citigroup was the biggest users of SIVs and also the one who structured so many of Enron's financial transactions. And it's just astonishing that the regulators would have allowed that to happen. Just absolutely astonishing. And I almost couldn't believe it. Even when we were finishing up the book and I was fact checking it, I was thinking, really, really, could that be true? So I find that shocking, and it does raise this interesting larger question that we dwell on a little bit in the book about financial innovation. You know, you hear that argument today when people talk about derivatives reform or whatever, that, well, it may quash financial innovation. I think to myself, and tell me exactly what good financial innovation has done.
Right. Oh, I'm sorry. Here we said we didn't have too many other questions, but unfortunately, more keep arising here.
That's okay.
Yeah, one of the things that has been really interesting and intriguing is questions about the relationship between the New York Fed and the Fed in Washington. Did you hear anything about that, sort of issues, tensions, pre-crisis, that may have played a role in how this played out?
About that. We didn't report on that a lot in the book. But I did hear, and there's a little passage in the book that one of the groups opposed to the lending guidelines that were finally rolled out in early 2006, wasn't it? Was it late 2006? I'm sorry, I'm
Do you mean the non-traditional guidance?
September 2006. Right. One of the players who was opposed to that was the New York Fed. And that was one of the voices, along with the OTS, that was not in favor of the guidelines.
Okay.
And when you said the New York Fed, that's a bunch of human beings. So who are we thinking of, really?
Geithner.
Yeah. And do you know specifically what the concern was?
I believe, as it was told to me, and I heard this at the very end of the book and squeezed in something about it, but it's worded in a very sort of careful way.
Mm-hmm.
I guess what I heard is that Geithner in the market, and his basic argument was that the market is making these types of loans possible, and who are we to question what the market... And I guess, you know, if you were... Well, I guess I should leave it there. Census is being taped.
Who are we to question what the market wants, or is that what you mean?
Yeah, who are we to question what the market is funding?
Mm-hmm. Do you think that there's any evidence that colored the thinking once he was in government?
I don't have. You could speculate a lot on the makeup of the New York Fed and the composition of its board and the people who the New York Fed would be in regular contact with.
Mm-hmm.
And you could draw some conclusions from that, I guess. But maybe that's on another level. You could say maybe that's unfair. Lots of things that appear to be causal aren't really, and so
mm-hmm.
so I never, I guess to answer your question specifically, I never dug into the details of those relationships, so I'm probably not the most qualified person to opine on them. I guess I just think there probably is something interesting there.
Is there anything interesting that you maybe understood or heard that maybe didn't make it into your book about Hank Paulson and the combination of having come from the street and then being part of the mop-up?
You know, I guess I emerged somewhat as a... I wouldn't say a... Well, let me think about the best way to say this. I guess I have a hard time faulting... Paulson plays a huge role in the crisis in most people's minds because he was the most visible face of the government as the crisis unfolded, and people view TARP as his, and obviously his relationship with Goldman has caused a lot of controversy. But I guess I think by the time Hank Paulson stepped into the position as Treasury Secretary, this stuff was pretty much baked in the cake.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not that maybe some drastic action in 2006, 2007 might have made things better, but I don't think you would have fixed the problems by that point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it would have taken a lot for an incoming Treasury Secretary to have been able to say, especially when Treasury really has no, you know, regulatory levers to pull, to be able to say, cut off subprime lending. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I have some sympathy for what Paulson would actually have been able to accomplish even if he had seen this coming. I think the factors that created this were built up over a period of a couple of decades, and I think by the time he stepped in, some sort of crisis was pretty inevitable. Go ahead.
You know, in his book he talked about how in the very early days of coming into the administration, he went to Camp David and had a nice weekend with the president. And you know, in his book, he talks about how he gave the president a little tutorial on the risks of derivatives and securitization and da-da-da-da-da. And he said he never mentioned housing. It never came up.
Yep.
And I guess as just a lay person, I thought that seemed kind of almost impossible for me to imagine having come from Goldman. Am I wrong about that?
I guess I think so, yeah, because the mortgage business was such a small part of Goldman's business. They didn't buy a residential real estate business like other firms did. And I don't see Paulson as the type of thinker who would have been thinking housing prices could decline dramatically.
Okay.
You know, he's a conventional thinker in some ways, and he bought into the widespread conventional notion that if housing prices went down, maybe they'd go down a little bit in some parts of the country. So I don't think he would have come into the position as Treasury Secretary with housing on his brain.
Okay.
And I think even as housing did get on his brain later on, I think for a long time when he said this is contained and this isn't going to be a problem, it's because he really thought that. And then, so you can fault him for not seeing it, but I don't think you can fault him for saying something he didn't believe.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you can ask, you know, you can ask a legitimate question that if Paulson were so concerned about derivatives and the risks, why didn't he do more in his position as CEO of Goldman?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Interesting. Thank you.
One other thing is, are there any sources out there that you think might be good sources of information for us at the FCIC, maybe people that you couldn't get to talk to you, but that the FCIC might be able to get? And is there anybody who needs to be reached?
I think this question that you raise about the New York Fed would be really interesting, and I think people you could get to that I couldn't would be lower-level regulators. Forget about the senior people. Talk to the people who were the sort of staff guys and women doing enforcement, and the staff people trying to do consumer protection, and how they felt within the regulatory agencies, and how the people who were actually trying to do enforcement felt. And I think that could yield some interesting stuff about the way regulators think and whether they really are outmatched and kind of what the institutional attitude of various regulators is.
Mm-hmm.
So
without asking
without
asking you any sources, can you suggest any names that come into your mind?
I can't really. Some of the few people I did talk to were gone. So that's the only way I was able to get to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Anything I have is more anecdotal than it is the kind of, you know, really detailed stuff you guys would be looking at and would be able to get. But I think that could be a hugely interesting area, because it would be really relevant toward the future in terms of how to prevent this again too, by kind of a better understanding of the regulatory mindset and the gap between what the people on the ground are doing or trying to do and what their superiors want to accomplish.
Well,
and I don't know, maybe it wouldn't yield anything interesting, and maybe you'd discover everybody's aligned and everybody's on board and everybody thought the same way. But you know, my suspicion would be senior people at regulators might be more politically attuned than the people on the ground, and it might be really interesting and relevant to the future if we're going to try to rely on regulators even more to stop the next crisis, to understand exactly how regulation works at the ground level.
Well, one thing that's a challenge in investigating this and reporting about this is that so many of the people who were instrumental in creating it remain in high-level positions today.
Yep.
And so anyone who's going to talk about what went wrong is going to have going to be doing it at some risk to themselves.
Right. Can you guys subpoena email from more? I mean, you did that in the case of the OTS, right, with the report you put out?
I'm sorry, what
but
did
I
you...
thought some of that was... I thought some of that was really telling. Was the Washington Mutual and the regulatory report, was that yours or was that the Senate? I forget.
That was the PSI.
That was the PSI, okay. But they had some really telling exchanges between OTS staffers that I thought were were pretty interesting. And if you could do the same thing at other regulators, particularly the Fed, you know, who knows if it would yield anything interesting.
Right. Well, it's a little easier to investigate the OTS now.
Yeah,
it's always easier to do an autopsy on a dead body.
Absolutely, and I totally sympathize with that. But you know, in the end, it would make us all feel really good if we could point a finger at the OTS and say they were the culprit. Everybody else was perfect. But obviously that's not true, right? Whatever problems the OTS had, the other regulators had too, or maybe they had different problems. But it's not as if. I mean, sure, OTS regulated institutions performed horribly, but so did Fed regulated institutions. So whatever breakdown happened at the OTS wasn't unique.
Here's another. I think that will this be our last question, gang? Okay. How about in Washington? Well, you gave us a good list of people that you thought played significant roles in Wall Street. How about what people played significant roles in Washington that are the names that you would mention?
Let's see. Well, I mentioned Greenspan. We did a bunch of work in the book on what happened with derivatives regulation over the years and the people who fought for it and the people who fought against it. And I think some of those names are pretty publicly out there. What in Congress? I think Senator Sarbanes, in terms of the predatory lending issues, was always on the side of the angels. But I actually think it's less a question of who did the right thing than that there's so few names that leap out. You know, it's really interesting. This is part of our book, and you've probably found this too, but there were regulators in the late 1990s who were really concerned about the issue of predatory lending, from Ellen Seidman at the OTS to Donna Tanui at the FDIC, and their proposals got marginalized and shot down basically with bipartisan support from Congress. So I think it's harder to name... It's almost harder to name anybody who was kind of on. In hindsight, it's 2020, of course, but it's harder to name people on the right side who were on the right side of the issue than people who were on the wrong side of the issue. And then, you know, with the GSEs, obviously, I think some of the Republican/Federal Reserve campaign against the GSEs was warranted. I think they were out of control institutions, and so I think both. Congressman Baker and Senator Shelby played a pretty activist role in trying to rein in the GSEs, and you know, I think the whole study of why nothing ever happened and no new regulation of the GSEs was passed until 2008 is just a a fascinating look at how dysfunctional Congress can be.
Well, it's a story with dollar signs attached, yes.
Yeah.
Oh,
and I'm
dollar signs, but also dollar signs accompanied by ideology, right? Everybody's fear of doing something that would get in the way of home ownership and being tarred with that brush when they went to campaign again.
Right.
So
right.
I think the combination of dollar signs and the sort of home ownership beacon.
Right.
Oh, and I'm sorry. One more question here. I wanted to ask you about AmeriQuest. I thought it was really interesting, the reference in your book. Of course, you have a chapter, you know, a good bit on AmeriQuest. But I thought it was really interesting that you said that Angelo Mozillo blamed AmeriQuest. That they
did, and you can find that in his public conference calls, that he blamed both AmeriQuest and New Century for really lowering the standards in the industry, and that he felt he had to compete with these companies.
Yeah, when did he say? When was that?
We have that.
We do. Okay.
I can't
remember, but it's in the book, and I think it's dated in the book. I just don't remember off the top of my head. But if you guys have it, then that whole notion is kind of fascinating to me. And I think Greenspan said in testimony before you that he couldn't. And I'm going to draw these two points together. I promise that he. that he couldn't, that he wouldn't have been able to do anything about lending because of pressure from Congress. And, you know, both of those points are true. When Mozilla says he had to keep up with subprime lenders, or his shareholders would have started questioning what he was doing, and when Greenspan says that he would have been shouted at by Congress if he had tried to do anything to rein in lending standards, and I'm paraphrasing his words, I don't remember them exactly, and I hope I'm getting the gist right, but I want to be careful on that. You know, they're both true. But on the other hand, if the most powerful CEOs in the country can't say this is the wrong path and I'm not going to do it, and if the purportedly independent chairman of the Federal Reserve can't say to Congress you're wrong, you know, why even bother having powerful CEOs or a purportedly independent Federal Reserve, right? So I guess I have sympathy for the argument on the one hand, and then absolutely no sympathy for it on the other hand.
Bethany, one last question. In
27 parts.
You mentioned that you're doing some press reporting on the foreclosure mess, and you may know that the FCIC's mission is also to include the economic meltdown after the crisis. And
no,
of course,
I didn't know.
Yes,
oh, interesting.
The 180 things the FCIC is supposed to do includes examining the economic impact of the financial meltdown. So my question to you is, because you're doing fresh reporting on the mess, the documentation and all of that, do you have any good sense, I'm not going to hold you to this, but do you think a book that comes out in December should make much or middling or light of this phase?
I should be careful when I start by saying I haven't done that much work on it. I've done a little bit. So I don't want to hold myself. There are people who have done, in the press, who have done much better and more detailed work than I have, so I don't want to hold myself up as some kind of
sure.
expert. I guess I would say middle, because it seems to me like part and parcel of the same themes continued. You know, a disregard for consumers that seems to be at the heart of a lot of this. A sort of arrogance about the banks, that they don't feel like they have to do things right, and then a kind of lack of investment in actually being able to run their businesses. And so those all seem like pretty powerful themes to me.
Okay. And familiar.
and extremely familiar themes. I mean, it's, you know, it's more of the same on some level.
Okay.
And it also seems, as I said earlier, to really point out this, and again, this is so anecdotal, but to really point out this gap between how banks perceive the world, how the financial industry perceives the world, and how consumers perceive the world. And it seems to me to be pretty enormous.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you guys very much. It was a pleasure. I hope I was semi-articulate. I wish you guys the best of luck in getting this done. It sounds like you have your hands full.
We do. Wish us well.
Thank you again. Have a nice weekend.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. You too.
Okay,
bye.
Good luck with the book.